Welcome to Breaking Down Patriarchy. I'm Amy McPhee Olivest. Today we're going to talk about a document from the 18th century that many consider a foundational text for women's rights, the Declaration of the Rights of Women and the Female Citizen by Olympe de Gouges. Though this is an essential text in challenging patriarchy, most people I know, even including myself until recently, have never heard of this declaration. But you may have heard of a certain other declaration written in the 18th century. You may recall that our Declaration of Independence talked about human rights, and that a certain Frenchman hung out with our founding fathers and participated in the American Revolution. As historians and Hamilton fans know, the Marquis de Lafayette went home to France after the American Revolution and helped to write his own revolutionary document, which was called the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. So think of Angelica Schuyler in Hamilton in America saying that if she met Thomas Jefferson, she was going to compel him to include women in the sequel. Well, in France, when a bunch of men published the Declaration of the Rights of Man, there actually was a woman who took it upon herself to include women in the sequel. She wrote the sequel herself, and her name was Olympe de Gouges. Her response to the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen was the Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen. And that's going to be the text that we discuss today. But first, let me introduce my reading partner for today's episode, Lindsay Olivest. Hi, Lindsay.
Hello.
So Lindsay Olivest, no relation. Just kidding. She's my daughter. Lindsay Olivest is 19 years old and will soon be starting her sophomore year at Boston University. She is a history major, and her favorite areas of study include ancient Greece and early modern Europe. Is that right?
That's about right, yeah.
Okay. When she is not reading and writing essays for school, she enjoys listening to indie and rock, but not indie rock, and playing board games with her family, which we have had the opportunity to do a lot lately. And one fun fact about Lindsay is that she recently completed a course on the French Revolution in college. And she taught our family a ton about French history as she had to come home in the spring and finish her class on Zoom due to the COVID shutdown. So we've been learning from her a lot about France, and she will bring that fresh information from her class to the text when we talk about it. So Lindsay, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me up into your room instead of mine, where I'd probably still be asleep if I wasn't doing this.
Well, I'm glad you came. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. To get us started, I'm going to introduce us to Olympe de Gouges, and I should mention how it's spelled because that was hard. When I heard her name, I could not imagine what, like, syllables, what that even meant. So it's Olympe, and I guess technically in French, they say Olympe.
I think it's more like Olympe in Olympe. French, okay. But we are not French.
We are not French. Lindsay has taken French at least for a couple of years.
I took French for 1 year in eighth grade.
Oh, okay. Well, that's still more French than I have had. Well, I'm just going to say Olympe because that's what it looks like. It's like Mount Olympus, O-L-Y-M-P-E. And then de Gouges, Gouges, her last name, G-O-U-G-E-S. Okay. And then Lindsay, just correct me if I get anything wrong, but this, just based on my online research and in the little biography that was in the beginning of the book, I'll introduce you to a little bit to this author. So, sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay. So, Olympe de Gouges was born Marie Gouze, that's spelled G-O-U-Z-E, in southwest France in 1748. Her family was middle class. She was the daughter of a baker, or possibly the illegitimate daughter of a nobleman. She claimed she was, but some people think that she made up that story. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we know that she had some education in her youth. That's apparent because she was a really great writer and she quotes philosophers and kind of engages with philosophical thinking. But she was married very young. She was married against her will at age 16 to one of her father's business associates. The following year, so when she was 17, Marie Gouges gave birth to her only child, a son, and her husband died. So 4 years later in 1770, so that would have been when she was, what, 21, she moved to Paris and became involved in some of the intellectual salons in the city. And rather than being known as her late husband's widow, Marie Gouges renamed herself, taking on her mother's middle name, Olymp or Olymp, and changing the spelling of her father's surname, so from Guz to Guge. And the De was kind of like an aristocratic styling of her name. So that's a pretty bold move, I feel like, to just invent her own name. So the salon she visited introduced her to well-known writers and politicians at the time. She also began a relationship with a wealthy businessman who supported her financially, but they never married. She never married again. And she actively rejected the institution of marriage. While in Paris, de Gouges started a theater company and began writing her own plays. These plays dealt with political issues such as the abolition of slavery, women's rights, and class inequality in France. She was a big target for harassment and criticism in Paris because of her radical opinions, but also simply because she was a female playwright. She was violently opposed to French colonization and slavery. She wrote works called, in English, the translation is Reflections on Black Men and the Slavery of Black People. I won't even try to pronounce the French because I'll ruin it, but she wrote about this issue extensively, and those works attracted fierce opposition. When the French Revolution began, de Gouges supported it. She was a strong advocate for economic and social change, especially regarding the abolition of slavery, as we mentioned, and women's rights. However, she did support the idea of reforming the monarchy rather than abolishing it, whereas the more radical groups wanted to execute King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, which, of course, they eventually did in 1793. But to back up, in order to understand the text that we're going to discuss today, which is de Gouges' Declaration of the Rights of Women and the Female Citizen, we need to understand the document that de Gouges was responding to, which was the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. And in order to understand the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, we have to understand the basics of what the French Revolution was and why it happened. So that's where Lindsay's going to take over, because that is her area of expertise and not mine.
Okay. So the French Revolution began largely as a consequence of an economic crisis and huge socioeconomic inequality. For hundreds of years, French society had been structured into a social hierarchy system that they called the Three Estates. The Three Estate system divided France's population into three social groups. At the top was the clergy, members of the Catholic Church. Well, not members exactly, but, you know,
priests
and ministers, all those people.
Okay.
Then the next down was the nobility, and at the bottom was the third estate, which included every other person in France. 96% of the total population were members of the third estate, and about 80% of the third estate were peasants.
Oof.
Terrible. So a huge percentage of the population was in poverty, and this poverty kept getting worse because of France's war debt and inefficient farming and huge waves of inflation. So after decades of this terrible situation, King Louis XVI, who already had a reputation for being weak and petty, finally called a meeting of the Estates General in 1789, which basically meant that representative members of each estate were brought to Versailles for a meeting. And if you've ever studied the French Revolution before, you might remember the Jacobin lawyer-turned-dictator Maximilien Robespierre.
Ah, yeah.
He was at the meeting.
Okay, yeah, I remember him from some history class deep, deep in my memory. Okay.
So for several weeks at the Estates General meeting, representatives of the Third Estate, which, remember, was the majority of France's population, most of whom were peasants, had to fight to be included in the discussions and voting.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, after about a month of tension, the Third Estate forcefully took over the proceedings and declared itself the National Assembly, basically the group in charge of France's political system. This was basically the first step toward the people delegitimizing the monarchy and seizing power for themselves, and it was pretty effective. In response, the king locked the National Assembly out of the meeting, so the representatives who were rebelling against the king got together on a handball court and wrote the famous tennis court oath, which is clearly misnamed as they were on more of a handball court.
That's funny.
Which swore that the National Assembly would not disband until they wrote a constitution for France.
Okay, wait, why have I heard of the tennis ball? Or the tennis court.
The tennis court oath. There's a pretty famous painting by what's his name? Jacques-Louis David? No.
David.
David. Yeah, I don't remember his first name, but David.
Yeah.
It shows all these men in this big room looking so emotional and excited and holding up like a piece of paper, just looking so excited about, you know, the promise of a reinvented future.
Wow. Okay. Yes. I remember that. I remember that painting, I think. I don't even know if I've ever learned about this period in French history, but I do remember the painting. Okay, anyway, keep going. This is fascinating.
So after this, after the meeting, rumors started flying around France that the king was going to crush the Third Estate and establish martial law to calm the country down. This led to the storming of the Bastille, which you've probably heard about, on July 14th.
Yep.
And basically mass chaos ensued, especially in Paris. There were 2 weeks of mob violence after the storming of the Bastille, beginning with the decapitation via knife, I should mention, and head piking of the governor of the Bastille, Governor Delaunay. Yeah.
It's like they literally cut his head off with a knife and put it on a pike.
Yeah, apparently I learned this in my class, that they had a sword and opted for a knife.
Oh my gosh.
Pretty terrible. It's hard to overstate, rather, the violence that occurred during that two-week period.
It's so disturbing that people have that in them, just like at the drop of, like, just the slightest thing can change and people just turn into animals.
Yeah. I mean, you can understand why they were so angry, but still, rage, it's pretty horrifying.
The pent-up rage that can just go out of control. Okay. Okay, keep going. Yes.
Yeah. So the reason for setting the stage with this much detail is just to illustrate that this was a country that was totally questioning all its foundations. The people were furious about the structural inequalities in their society, and they wanted to tear it down and build something new and better in its place. Some of the changes that they wanted to make were, one, abolishing feudalism, two, abolishing tithes to the Catholic Church, and reducing or eliminating the influence of the church in general. And third, establishing a meritocracy, where every citizen is eligible for every job. You could basically determine what you wanted to do with your life. So to enshrine these principles in a document, much like America's Declaration of Independence and Constitution, the Marquis de Lafayette and some other men wrote the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, which was published in 1789 as the preamble to the Constitution that came 2 years later. This document asserted that men have natural rights, which was a pretty new concept that was developed during the Enlightenment. It also asserted that all men's natural rights were equal to each other. Basically, you don't have more natural rights because your dad is a duke or a count. All men are created equal.
Right, right. So that's like completely revolutionary compared to what you talked about earlier with the three estates. Like, you're just born into basically your caste. It's like a caste system.
Yeah.
And this is upending that and saying, nope, every little baby that's born is equal in value and equal and will have equal protections under the law, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's pretty radical.
This document is considered hugely important in the history of human rights.
Yeah.
And it was a huge, huge step forward for the oppressed citizens of France who were male and white.
Right.
It didn't acknowledge enslaved people at all. And it didn't mention women at all. I can just imagine how infuriating that would have been.
Yeah.
I would have thought, like, really? You're going to all this trouble of dismantling the power structure in order to form a new, more just society from scratch, and you completely forgot about us.
Totally.
I would be so mad.
I would be so mad, too. Yeah.
And for the record, I am mad about it.
Yeah, seriously. I'm mad, too, when I read that. And that's actually, that was so helpful to have all of that context before to build up, like, the despair and the anger. And then the hope that some people must have felt and that women must have felt. They must have been so angry to have that document come out and be like, okay, so like, what are the changes you've made? Oh, nothing. Like, you've completely forgotten about us.
Although, to be fair, Olympe de Gouges was pretty radical in writing this document. I think a lot of women in France probably weren't that upset about it. I think maybe some of them, or most of them, didn't think to be included in the Constitution or in this preamble. They didn't feel that they had rights equal to men. I think a lot of women just didn't think of that.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point and actually really sad. Wait, maybe this is getting ahead of ourselves, but when Olympe de Gouges died, or right before her death, she was attacked
by a group of women.
Right.
Yeah, a group of Jacobin women.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that actually is a really good point, how radical she was that even women, like, well, yes, exactly what you said, that they wouldn't have considered themselves equal to men, or mm-hmm. it would just wouldn't have crossed their minds.
Yeah.
Great point. Okay, but Olympe de Gouges did feel compelled to write this document and kind of like rally mm-hmm. the women, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, so Olympe de Gouges took this Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, and she wrote this new document called the Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen. And she took every article of the original declaration and applied it to men and women, point for point.
Hmm.
She published it in 1791, and immediately after she published it, many of the radicals of the revolution accused her of treason. The Jacobins, led by Robespierre, who we mentioned earlier, called her a royalist, which, to be fair, wasn't entirely untrue, since de Gouges did support the monarchy. Okay. She wanted these principles of equality to be guaranteed by a constitutional monarchy, and she had dedicated the declaration to Marie Antoinette, whom everyone loathed.
Yeah, that's pretty gutsy that she did that.
De Gouges was tried for treason and was sentenced to execution by the guillotine. I'd also like to add that in 1791, the revolution was already trending towards a much more radical phase. Robespierre was gaining a lot of power, and this is right before the Reign of Terror that you've probably heard about.
Right.
So almost, you know, people who wanted a constitutional monarchy were kind of left in the dust, and those were the people being beheaded.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And she really was, like, she was beheaded, right?
She was guillotined, yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Her crime, according to the newspaper at the time when she was sentenced, was that she had, quote, forgotten the virtues which belonged to her sex.
Ugh.
So she was beheaded on November 3rd, 1793, at the age of 45.
Ah, that just kills me. That is so tragic. That's really telling. That's interesting. I mean, like you said, they're beheading tons and tons of people, most of whom were men.
Yeah.
But that's really telling that that the paper published that one of her crimes, at least, that was her perceived crime, was that she had forgotten the virtues which belonged to her sex, which would have been at the time, what would those virtues have been?
Staying home, being quiet, and having children.
Yeah.
I learned this statistic in my class, that women in France at the time conceived every 20 months on average. That's less than 2 years apart.
Wow.
Yeah.
So really, truly, it was like, women really were completely confined to the domestic sphere. And they kind of had to be, I guess, if they were having a baby every 20 months.
Yeah.
Or conceiving a baby every 20 months.
Mm-hmm.
But that it's not just the circumstances that kept them out. They were prescribed to stay in their box, basically, and not speak out publicly.
Yeah. I mean, there were women like Olympe de Gouges. We know that in the social circles she was in Paris, there were other female playwrights. And, you know, other female intellectuals who spent time in salons talking with one another, but they didn't have careers. And do you know their names?
Yeah,
no.
No.
Yeah. So, you know, educated women who were, you know, in the upper classes, they had some more opportunities, but they were still not allowed to really leave the domestic sphere publicly.
Sure. Yeah, because they would have been presuming to be leaders of men, right?
Yeah.
Which is not allowed.
Mm-hmm. Not allowed.
Yeah. Okay, wow. Well, that was an awesome introduction to this document. And this is an interesting document, too, because it's not like books that we've read and that we will continue to read on the podcast. It's basically like short, concise sentences.
Mm-hmm.
They're just a few articles of the Declaration. So what we're going to do is we selected a few of the articles, and actually all of them are really interesting. And we had a hard time narrowing it down, but we selected a few that we think are especially interesting and still relevant to today. So, Lindsay, do you want to read the first one that we selected?
Absolutely. So, I thought that Article 1 and Article 4 were fairly similar to each other, and they're really short, so I'm going to read them both.
Okay.
Article 1. Woman is born free and remains equal to man in her rights. Social distinctions may only be based on common utility. And Article 4. Liberty and justice consist in restoring to others all that belongs to them. Hence, the only limits to the exercise of the natural rights of woman are found in the perpetual male tyranny opposed to them. These limits must be reformed according to the laws of nature and reason.
Okay. So a couple things. I mean, actually, a lot of things jump out to me. There's a lot to unpack here. But one thing that stands out to me in Article 1, she says, woman is, quote, born free and remains equal to man in her rights. So that is referring to what you said about natural rights, that mm-hmm. babies are equal, you know, they're born equal in their rights to, again, protection by the Constitution, and they're equal in value, mm-hmm. right, as human beings.
Yeah.
But she cites natural rights. And so, of course, I agree with her. I mean, mm-hmm. of course I do. And that was a, like you said before, that had developed during the Enlightenment, that men and now women too came to see themselves as having natural rights that they're born with. And so if somebody doesn't respect those natural rights, it's like they're taking away something that they already have.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that jumps out to me is that that's slightly different from our Declaration of Independence. And just to play the devil's advocate, I'm just thinking, like, how would somebody argue with de Gouges here? And one thing that comes to mind is that some people would say, well, who gives that baby his rights, right? Mm-hmm. I know in America, in the Declaration of Independence, it says that all men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're endowed by the creator, that the creator that they're referring to, at least in our document, is the Judeo-Christian God in the Bible. And that God, I mean, if you do look at Genesis, he does not endow Adam and Eve with equal rights and equal roles, actually.
No, not at all.
Right? So that just, what stands out to me from that, I mean, it's in the biblical account, Eve is created from Adam's rib. So it's not mm-hmm. like they're even created equal. She's like created mm-hmm. from his body.
Yeah.
Adam names her and she's like explicitly made subject to Adam, and after she causes the fall of man. So they don't have the same natural rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so this basis, like Elim de Gouges talks about social distinctions, like a literalist who reads the Bible would say, well, God made those social distinctions and mm-hmm. he subjugated woman to man. Yeah. And so, and someone might be able to just say, well, like that's an appeal to natural rights in that case would be futile because if you believe that God created that system. And if you look at if you look at theocracies around the world, that's really dangerous, right? To have like a religious text be your basis for your law, because there are places all around the world still, right, that say, well, God mm-hmm. says women can't go to school. God says women can't work. God says women shouldn't speak, right? And not just women, of course, like mm-hmm. this has been misused all over the world in all different times. So anyway, what stands out to me from that is how tricky it is, but how really, really important it is to have a separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's my takeaway from that. And my understanding, Lindsay, correct me if I'm wrong, but is that France actually was really deliberately secular at mm-hmm. this point, right? You said they were kind of divorcing from the authority of the Catholic Church. Is that manifest here?
Yeah, the revolution, the hierarchy in France that existed before was justified by God. They believed that their king, King Louis XVI and all the kings before him, had the divine right of kings, they were endowed with their creator, with the right to rule, or endowed by their creator mm-hmm. with the right to rule. And even the Pope kind of ranked above the king. The Catholic Church controlled the government. It was intertwined with the government, and the revolutionaries saw how that created inequality, and they did not want that.
That's interesting. That would be so interesting and we won't have time to do it tonight, but to compare the the trajectory, the social path and the social trajectory of France next to the United States, because we have so much in common, mm-hmm. but just to through that lens mm-hmm. of the secular versus the United States still was grounded so much. Even just that one tiny little phrase that mm-hmm. they're endowed by their creator, mm-hmm. that makes a big difference for women's rights, at least in my mind when I was looking at this. Okay.
Totally.
That was the first thing that I thought of. What stood out to you from those articles?
Well, I think it's interesting that Elim de Gouges is using the argument of natural rights just based on nature and reason. That's what she says, mm-hmm. according to the laws of nature and reason. Which is not a religious argument. Like you said, it's totally secular.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting. And it's totally coming from all these Enlightenment ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, you know, just like the religious argument has been used to justify hierarchy, so has an argument of natural rights based on nature and reason. Mm. It makes me think of Aristotle, who, you know, he was a biologist and he saw all these things in nature and he saw the way that society worked. And he said that people had, in his Politics, he said that people have different, like, different characteristics. Like, some people are rulers and some right. people are ruled. That right. men naturally rule women and masters naturally rule the people that they enslave.
Right.
He totally believed in nature. He was a biologist and he used that to justify hierarchy.
Yeah. You know what? That reminds me. Just yesterday, actually, I was looking at Darwin, mm-hmm. Darwin's Descent of Man, mm-hmm. and I did not know this, but Darwin had similar ideas, mm-hmm. at which maybe were influenced by Aristotle, mm-hmm. but just that exact same thing. Well, women mm-hmm. are smaller, women are weaker, mm-hmm. women are, it's biologically inevitable mm-hmm. that women are not going to be as intelligent and they're not capable mm-hmm. of certain things. So that's... Yeah, that's really discouraging. So even when you say, like, we're just going to look at nature and reason, mm-hmm. like, who do you look to? If you can't look to the ancient Greeks for reason, yeah. like, as a woman, what do you appeal to say, wait, like, I promise we are
equal to you.
Equal to you yeah. in value, in intellect, mm-hmm. in potential. We're smaller, but in every other way, we're equal. Like, mm-hmm. where do you base your philosophical argument?
I don't know. I don't know. It's so hard.
Oh, okay. I just thought of one, mm-hmm. actually. Okay, so I learned about this philosophical thought experiment called the Veil of Ignorance, mm-hmm. where in this thought experiment, you imagine that if you're going to create a just society, let's say you and I are mm-hmm. tasked with creating a just society.
Okay.
Okay, so we get together and we say, okay, we're thinking of implementing this particular policy or practice. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we say, we're going to do this. We write down whatever that policy is. Mm-hmm. And then we think through every single person in society and we write down how that will impact those members of society. Mm-hmm. So the veil of ignorance is that once we've made that plan, we're going to do this and here's how everybody's going to be impacted. Then we pass through this veil. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, we find out which member of society we're going to be.
Okay.
So there's ignorance in that we don't know what we're going to be assigned. So anything that we think like, yeah, I think slavery sounds good, right? Mm-hmm. So then we're forced to say like, okay, what will be the implications for the master? Great, that. What will be the implications for the slave? X, Y, Z. If it's just, then we are perfectly happy that when we step over to the other side being handed the card and say, you get this guy, you are going to be the slave. If we're happy with that, it's a just policy. It's a just procedure. If we are not, if mm-hmm. we're not willing to be someone in society, then it's not just.
Right.
Okay. So I would imagine that if these men had thought of this thought experiment, they would maybe not be super thrilled about the thought of being women.
No. Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
So anyway, that's maybe something that they could think about.
I hope that in the future they do think of that.
yes, that's true, since we're still having these same conversations mm-hmm. and fighting these same battles. Okay. Okay, let's go on to some of the next articles. Do you okay. mind reading the next one?
Yeah, I'll read. So this is Article 6 and Article 13. Article 6. The law should be the expression of the general will. All citizens, female and male, should participate in person or through their representatives in its formation. It should be the same for all. Female and male citizens, being equal in the eyes of the law, should be equally eligible for all public positions of rank, offices, and employment, according to their ability and with no other distinction than those of their virtue and their talent.
Powerful.
Powerful indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, and Article 13, which is similar. The contributions of women and men to the maintenance of public authority and to administrative costs are equal. Women share in all the drudgery and all the painful tasks. Therefore, they must have the same share in the distribution of posts, employment, offices, rewards, and responsibilities.
Wow. It just feels like really nothing has changed, honestly.
Yeah, it does.
It feels so current. Uh-huh. Wow. Okay. I had a thought on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I just happened to have watched this clip that's on YouTube. Well, actually, I happened to have watched it. I sent it to you too, remember?
Oh, yeah, you did.
Okay. I don't know if you had a chance to watch it, but this clip of Good Morning America from 1975. Mm-hmm. So it's like a couple years before I was born. And Betty Friedan, who wrote The Feminine Mystique, and Phyllis Schlafly, who is mm-hmm. your arch nemesis.
My arch nemesis. I'm going to fight her in the afterlife.
We cannot say that name in our house because then we get so riled up. Okay. So Betty Friedan and Phyllis Schlafly are debating the Equal Rights Amendment, right? It's 1975.
Mm-hmm.
I was blown away. I could not believe how similar the arguments were. It was just like they had taken Olympe de Gouges' articles and were debating them, but they just mm-hmm. had their giant butterfly collars. Like the clothing was different and mm-hmm. they weren't in powdered wigs. It was the same conversations. And it was depressing to me that I just thought, and what I thought of is how in the Gerda Lerner texts that we did before, how Lerner just says that one of the tragedies of women not knowing our history is that women are just constantly reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
We just can't make progress because mm-hmm. we don't learn in school or anywhere about mm-hmm. our history. And that actually rings true to me, especially in this context. I had never heard of Olympe de Gouges seriously until I think you said her name, honestly. Mm-hmm. It was from your class, right?
Possibly, I guess. Yeah. We talked about her in my class.
Yes. I think it was literally you brought her up in the spring and I didn't even, again, know what word you were saying when you said her name. I never heard of her. I had never heard of the Equal Rights Amendment, Lindsay, until you were born already. I was like 25. I had never heard of it. I didn't even know it existed. Uh-huh. I thought women had equal rights guaranteed. And I remember my friend like kind of giving me a little bit of the history and mm-hmm. just reeling, realizing that that hadn't been passed yet.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think I learned about it till my junior year of high school, which is, you know, earlier than being 25, but still.
Yeah, that's not right.
Still, I didn't hear about it.
Yeah. And the real tragedy, of course, is like Olympe de Gouges. Well, you know what? Maybe to frame this positively instead of tragically, because we could do either.
Yeah.
But really, it just highlights what a forward-thinking woman she was.
Mm-hmm.
Like this, the fact that she immediately, when she read that declaration, was mm-hmm. like, absolutely not. We are rewriting this mm-hmm. constitution mm-hmm. right away. It's 230 years after Olympe de Gouges and the Declaration of the Rights of Woman. And we in the United States, not only are we not rewriting the Constitution, we can't even get an amendment to our Constitution that says that women can't be discriminated against on the basis of sex.
Mm-hmm.
So again, to frame it positively, what a queen, right? Like what a brave and smart and forward-thinking woman she was. Mm-hmm. To Agreed. See that needed to be done right away. Well, and it wasn't. But
it
at
was
least
not.
She knew. At
she
least
fought for it.
She fought for it. Okay.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay. Should we go on?
Yeah. Do you want to read the next article?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay. So the next article that we picked was Article 12. Article 12. Guaranteeing the rights of woman and the female citizen requires the existence of a greater good. This guarantee must be instituted for the advantage of all and not for the private benefit of those on whom it is conferred.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do you think?
Well, she's saying that guaranteeing the rights of women and protecting women benefits everybody, not just the individual women who want more privileges. All of society benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you convince people of that? Because people are always going to say, oh, you want to make this big change? What's in it for me?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, and you know what, we run into this, and one of the big, like, values in this project, which I said from the very introductory episode, is that dismantling patriarchy benefits men also, and mm-hmm. that this project isn't about, like, women bashing men, or right. women wanting power, right?
Of course not, yeah.
From the very beginning, even with The Chalice and the Blade, our very first book, the goal is egalitarianism. The goal is partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And partnership benefits both men and women. In fact, mm-hmm. I even read an article recently, I think we were talking about this, that in Iceland, which is the most egalitarian country, it has been like for the last decade, mm-hmm. in their practices in terms of like workload and childcare and all of those metrics, where men and women are equal and more equal in pay and stuff, mm-hmm. the men's life expectancy is actually longer.
Yeah.
And they, and men and women report greater levels of happiness.
Yeah.
So it actually really does, it does benefit men. It doesn't, all of the pressure that, that increase like rates of suicide in men when there's an economic downturn and just the pressure to always be strong and to never cry and to mm-hmm. never show your emotion, like the egalitarian model of just sharing the load and mm-hmm. supporting each other is healthier for men as well as healthier for women.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but the other point, I guess, is something that you said when we were having that conversation earlier. Oh, is mm-hmm. you remember what you said?
Yeah. I said, why do we have to prove this to you?
Yeah.
Like, why do we have to prove to you that you will be benefited by this change? Why can't you just give us what we want? Like, give, respect us equally and give us equal rights and equal protection.
Yeah. Without needing there to be something in it for you, right?
Yeah.
You would think that men, just by virtue of being a member of a family, right? Like, mm-hmm. every little, most little boys have a mother and or have a sister or mm-hmm. that you would think that there would be enough empathy there that they mm-hmm. would think like, this isn't fair that mm-hmm. I'm getting all of these privileges that my sister isn't getting. And that would be enough to make them say, of course it should be more equal.
Yeah.
Instead, Dagoge has to say like, we promise this will be better for you too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a shame that we have to make those promises instead of asking once and being listened to.
Right. And saying, oh yeah, that actually isn't fair. Let's fix this.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Next. Will you read the next one?
Yes, of course. Okay. This is Article 16. Any society that is without guaranteed rights and separation of powers is without a constitution. A constitution is void if the majority of individuals comprising the nation has not cooperated in its drafting.
Ah, yes. Okay, so immediately what comes to mind, you go to BU, mm-hmm. and you know every time we go to Boston, I have to at least see the Women's Monument, right?
Yes, yeah. I think it's on Commonwealth Ave.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think. The one with all the trees and all the statues.
Yes, like which is my same street, by the way, yeah. just farther down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah uh-huh. that's right. Yeah, because we walk past it, exactly. Uh-huh. So there's a statue, there are a bunch of statues on this street, and on this beautiful tree-lined, like, avenue in the mm-hmm. middle of Boston. And there's a trio of sculptures of mm-hmm. Phyllis Wheatley mm-hmm. and Lucy Stone.
Yeah.
And Abigail Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And I cry most times when I visit it. I do my little pilgrimage.
Yes.
And Abigail Adams, in fact, I wrote down this quote because I knew I wanted to mention it. Anyway, Abigail Adams had that famous letter to mm-hmm. John Adams when he, I think it was right after he had been elected president.
President or vice president?
I don't remember.
Probably president.
Okay, let's just say to be safe that he was in a position of a lot of power.
Yeah.
And they were exchanging letters because they were separated. Not separated like their marriage wasn't separated, but they weren't living in the same place because he was living in the Capitol and she was at home taking care of the kids. And they were exchanging letters, and she's giving him advice and counsel about like, okay, you've got this fancy new job now. And she says, and by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. I guess I would take exception to that. I'm just going to insert that there. That's not the part that I really want to highlight, but I resume the quote. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. And that's the part that I thought of course, because mm-hmm. that's what Dagoge is saying. She, in that last part of the article that you read, where the Constitution is void if the majority of individuals comprising the nation has not cooperated in its drafting.
Mm-hmm.
We are not going to hold ourselves bound by any laws
mm-hmm.
in which we have no voice or representation. It's
yeah.
just logical.
Yeah. I mean, how many women signed the Declaration of Independence? How many Black people? How many any person other than white and male?
Right.
Like,
and landowners.
And landowners, too, right? Yeah. All of those people, you know, most of whom owned slaves also. They enslaved people. I should not have to follow that, in my opinion. Like, that Constitution does not represent me. The Declaration does not have my interests at heart. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not a government that was founded for all people.
Yeah. No, you're right. Well, you and Olympe de Gouges are kindred spirits then, because yes. It's exactly what she wrote.
Yeah.
And again, in the moment, right after the Declaration came out, it was kind of like, yeah, what a nice try. Let's try that again. Yeah. Right? Like,
immediately putting herself in the conversation and saying, we have to fix this now.
Right.
As opposed to Abigail Adams, who,
right,
you know, despite making this really genuine and, I think, great claim to her husband, who had a lot of power, and I love that she was able to say something like this to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said earlier that, do you want to just compare the two, how their like, arguments are different?
Well, yeah, just that Abigail Adams is still kind of thinking within the confines of the patriarchy, right? Because she's saying, like, she's making an entreaty to him.
Yeah.
She's saying, you're the one in power. And right, so I am asking you if you will please remember the ladies and you make the laws that will put us in better position in society. But yeah, de Gouges is like, no, I'm writing these.
Yeah.
But I guess that in the end, they're both making that argument of, I mean, Abigail Adams, by saying that she's not going to hold herself to any law in which she has no voice or representation, that's kind of a precursor to the suffrage movement for women, I would think.
Yeah, true.
Right? Is that what you were remembering that I said, or is there something else?
No, no.
You can just say it.
That's about it. Yeah, just that, you know, Abigail is making a smaller ask. Like, please remember me.
Yep.
Do this for me.
Yep.
As opposed to de Gouges immediately taking action.
Right. So, yeah, so empowered. So radical. And she paid for it with her life.
She did, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. Okay, so those are all of the articles
that we wanted to cover.
Yes, those are definitely not all of the articles, but those are the ones that we had pinpointed. Was there anything in the postscript is really interesting, too, and had some things that definitely resonated for me on a personal level. Was there anything in the postscript that you wanted to highlight?
Well, I just remember the first line of the postscript, I believe, is women wake up.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's the message of this, is that, well, it's one of the messages. Obviously, her main goal is to put this into the government, is to implement this. Mm-hmm. But she's also calling for women to read this, you know, all the women who could read this at the time, and saying, like, wake up, be angry with me. And help me also fight for this. And I think that rings true today. Like, women wake up, listen to this podcast, and realize that there's stuff that we still have to fight for.
Yeah, there's work still to be done. Totally. Yeah, I agree. And we're going to end in just a minute, actually. We'll end with that exact quote, because that really stood out to both of us, I think. One other thing is in the postscript that really just resonated as still relevant, sadly. Was she says, let's see, she talks about men that just abandon their wives. Mm-hmm. And some of the articles that we didn't highlight today talk about women's right to identify their children's paternity, like identify the father of their children. Mm-hmm. At the time, women couldn't even make a claim if they're raped or if they had an affair or whatever the circumstance. If you think of like Fantine from Les Miserables or something, that women had absolutely no recourse. They were not believed. A man could just have his way or have an affair with a woman, and then just it was he said, she said, and he could just walk away and have absolutely no responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so de Gouges talks about that, I think, a couple of different times in the articles. And then in the postscript, she talks about how just vile it is and how awful it is for a man to partner with a woman, especially like for a long period of time. And then once she is older and has lost her value, because her value is in her looks, to abandon her.
Yeah.
Because at that point in time, women, I mean, not even being allowed to work, usually. I mean, I guess some like tradespeople worked and that their peasants had to do work, but they couldn't really support themselves. They were extremely financially dependent on their husbands after marriage, and that women were just completely often destitute and would live on the street and become prostitutes. And that was a huge thing that she talks about in the postscript, but it still rings true today. There are better laws in place in terms of alimony and child support, but they're still not enforced as well as they should be. And I do have several friends actually in my life who found themselves in similar situations where they've been in a marriage for a while and then they're just discarded. And if they haven't invested in their own financial independence, they are completely, they're like at the mercy of these men, as if it were 200 years ago, almost. So my advice to you, my love, is to make sure that you don't put yourself in such a vulnerable situation. And it was just heartbreaking to see, like, again, I guess how little has changed in some ways, but then it was heartening to realize that at least now there are laws that do protect women at least better than they used to.
True.
Anyway, anything else? Or did we get most of the stuff?
I think we got most of it.
Okay. Well, that was awesome. Lindsay, thank you so much for doing this with me. This was a joy.
Of course. I love you. Thank you for inviting me.
I love you too. Thank you. Okay, we're going to end the podcast by reading this excerpt from the postscript that Lindsay mentioned. First, I have to say that she starts by talking about the word toxin, which sounds like the word T-O-X-I-N, but it's actually T-O-C-S-I-N, which means an alarm bell. So when she says the toxin of reason, it's not like that reason is toxic.
No.
It's an alarm bell of reason. So I'll read just a small excerpt, and that's how we'll close out. Woman, awake. The toxin of reason is sounding across the universe. Acknowledge your rights. Nature's powerful empire is no longer hemmed in by prejudice, fanaticism, superstition, and lies. The torch of truth has dispersed all the clouds of folly and usurpation. Enslaved man has multiplied his strength and has needed yours to break his chains. But once free, he has become unjust to his companion. Oh, women, women, when will you cease to be blind? What advantages has the revolution brought you? Still greater contempt, still more overt disdain. You must courageously counter these vain pretensions of superiority with the power of reason. You must unite under the banner of philosophy. Deploy all your energy of character, and you will soon see these arrogant men not groveling at your feet in servile adoration, but proud to share with you the treasures of the Supreme Being. Whatever barriers are placed before you, it is in your power to overcome them. All you need is the will. So that ends our discussion on the Declaration of the Rights of Woman and the Female Citizen by Olympe de Gouges. And your assignment for next time is to read The Vindication of the Rights of Women by Mary Wollstonecraft. Wollstonecraft takes up the torch that was passed to her by de Gouges, and she writes one of the great works of women's rights. She's famous for engaging in a vigorous debate with Rousseau, and also she's famous for being the mother of Mary Shelley, who you'll remember is the author of Frankenstein. A really interesting woman and a really powerful text that is in direct conversation with the text we read today. So your assignment is to read up on the Vindication of the Rights of Women and also to pass the ERA. Thanks. See you next time on Breaking Down Patriarchy.